It has been an auspicious week. I don't know if many of you noticed, but Tuesday marked the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's speech against the Vietnam War that he delivered at Riverside Church in Manhattan. And if you read about that, there's striking parallels to current events. David Garreau writes that Dr. King remained relatively mute about the war through most of 1966, but by year's end, he was expressing private disgust at how increased military spending had torn a gaping budget hole in Johnson's Great Society's domestic programs. Everything we're talking about really boils down to the fact that we have this war on our hands, Dr. King said in yet another wiretapped phone call. In early 1967, after seeing images of Vietnamese children with burns from napalm, he said, "I came to the conclusion that I could no longer remain silent about an issue that was destroying the soul of our nation." The speech highlighted how, for Dr. King, civil rights was never a discrete problem in American society, and that racism went hand in hand with the fellow evils of poverty and militarism that kept the country from living up to its ideals. The speech also reflected his increasing political courage. He knew the risk of his prophetic outspoken call, and a year and a day later, he was assassinated. So Wednesday was the 49th anniversary of King's assassination. The day he was assassinated, I was 15 years old. Thursday, America responded to the images of children suffering and dying from a chemical attack in Syria. And then we bombed a Syrian airfield with cruise missiles. And we can hope that good results come from that initiative. And you can hear back in Martin Luther King's moment of, "I have to act." You can also hear a reflection of at least what we hear from our president's reaction to pictures of children in Syria, that we have to react. We can hope that we live up to our ideals. And we can also hope that we find a way to help Syrian refugees who would like to come to this country. Today is Palm Sunday. It's the Sunday where, as the story goes, Jesus did what he had to do. He knew the risk. He had to. He was the Son of God. He knew the risk, and he took it. He walked into Jerusalem and then the events that led to Easter. So to me, Palm Sunday is always a powerful message and reminder to overcome the inertia that is holding us back from the life we need to be living. It's a message and reminder to identify the move that we need to make for authentic engagement with how we are meant to be. And then to take those first steps toward that resurrection. Our mission statement begins by saying that we are an inclusive community of faith, where faith is understood not as an assent to propositions, but as that broader, deeper meaning of our lives. It's the why for how we live. We are a community, as Reverend Maureen Caloran says, bearing stubborn witness that what we do with our lives matters. That is, the choices we make, the actions we take, the lives we lead are important. They, we, matter. Maureen finishes by saying, "And a caring world is possible after all." Bearing stubborn witness that what we do with our lives matters, and that a caring world is possible after all. We make a difference. Or as Martin Luther King paraphrased Theodore Parker, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." As much as I emphasize religion as a word of orientation, the last few months have been very disorienting for many of us, for many different reasons. I told you that in February at one of our meetings where we were planning for the Changing Conflict to Community event that we actually held last week and a couple of our people participated in. One of the ministers in the planning committee had to leave. The person just felt that they couldn't participate. They said they were too upset by events, and they said they weren't even sure the arc really bent toward justice. It felt like it had taken a U-turn. I understood how he felt, but I, at the same time, wasn't in that space. And I'm the Unitarian Universalist minister in that crowd. This is where faith comes in. Our faith as a structure of meaning. Our traditions tell us that meaning is to be found feeling that we have lived meaningful lives, experiencing life as good, is somehow connected with caring beyond ourselves. And I would add, as we are able. And that so doing makes a difference. It makes the nature of the inclusive universe real in our lives and then in our world. Someone asked this week if we are a spiritual movement or merely a social justice movement. I said, we can really be neither without some connection to the other. We are an orientation to life and love, an experienced, wisdomed approach to the question, what does it mean to live well? Live well, not merely comfortable or safe, although these are important, but with meaning, soul, and grounded goodness. We care. And the faith of our traditions, our orientations, is why we care. I'd say we are an engaged spirituality. If you look at number 562 in our hymnal, it's by Mother Teresa, and it's called A Lifelong Sharing. And you'll remember, once you hear it, it begins by saying, love cannot remain by itself. It has no meaning. Love cannot remain by itself. It has no meaning. Love has to be put into action, and that action is service. Whatever form we are, able or disabled, rich or poor, it is not how much we do. Register that as you're putting love into service. It is not how much we do, but how much love we put in the doing. A lifelong sharing with others. Buddha would say, that's the middle way. Or in my notes, I jotted down, it's sort of the Goldilocks approach. Neither too hot nor too cold, but just right. And it fits different tastes. Many of us feel more engaged than we have in a long time. At the same time, we are concerned that our energy and commitment will fade back to our complacency. We fear that our actions will not make a difference. And as Annie Dillard says, we think it's never been like this ever before. It has. We think our politicians have never behaved like this ever before. They have. We think we are not sure we are up for it. Whatever it is, we are. Last week, we finished the last of our six-session history class, tracing the roots of Unitarian and Universalism from its roots in early Christianity all the way through to the present. We moved from the 16th century in Eastern Europe to England to the United States in the late 18th century and on to today. The class helped give us perspective. It also helped give us that perspective that this has happened before. Things have happened like this before. We saw that as Unitarian Universalists and people of engaged faith and spirituality, this is who we've always been. And this is when we've been at our best, by living and loving through it, whatever it is, together. Live your values and vision and justice. Be resilient and stay the course. Now, this is sort of one of those history sermons, but don't worry, I'm not going back to early Christianity. From my Beacon write-up, or for my Beacon write-up, actually, I picked three historical figures, all of whom are connected to each other and to that idea of a moral arc of the universe: William Ellery Channing, Theodore Parker, and Susan B. Anthony. I'll start with Channing. Historian David Robinson says that his 1819 sermon, Unitarian Christianity, stands as the defining statement of the movement. After he gave that sermon, Unitarianism could no longer just be seen as, quote, a liberal wing of New England Congregationalism, close quotes, but was something on its own. Jesus was not God. He was the Son of God, but there could only be one God. And then we as fellow humans could be like him. We could be like Jesus. An exalted view of human possibility with Jesus as an exemplar. And as we've said, as our awareness of the world has grown and religion has grown, we know there are many exemplars that answer the question, what does it mean to live well in right relationship with all that is? Those religious exemplars are what it means to live well. We saw in the history series pictures of several present-day town squares in New England where the Congregationalist church was built across the street from what is now the Unitarian Universalist church. There had only been one, but in many cases it was the conservatives who moved out. They said, you're just too liberal, you Unitarians, and they moved out and built their church on the other side or down the street on the square. The other night, it was Monday night, I was in a meeting sitting next to Richard Weidler, who's the minister of the First Congregational Church. And it was at a meeting where, it was actually a forum at Trinity Presbyterian Church. I'll tell you about it later, but it was put on by Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and it was about religion and gender identity, or religion and homosexuality. So I was sitting next to Richard Weidler. He had his Bible, and I didn't. I told Jerry, you've got lots of biblical authorities. So it was sort of the church on the square. Richard on one side, me on the other. Channing remained a biblical Unitarian, but he influenced those who would become known as transcendentalists. They made the next liberal move where God, the holy, is not limited to the scriptures, but is to be experienced in the world and our relationship in and of the universe. Again, there's me next to Reverend Weidler. How we are to be in the world is reflected in the creation around us. The holy transcends our forms. And that moves us into our next name for today, Theodore Parker. He was a leader in that transcendentalist movement and a friend of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Annie Dillard references Emerson, and Annie Dillard is an Episcopalian in her remarks. In 1841, Parker preached his sermon, A Discourse on the Transient and the Permanent in Christianity. In it, the historian David Robinson writes, Parker argued that most of the traditional supports of Christian beliefs, such as biblical miracles, the inspiration of the scriptures, and the divinity of Jesus, were transient rather than permanent and necessary parts of religion. That is, they were designed by us to meet our needs, and they could pass away. Many Unitarian ministers thought that was just too radical, so they ostracized Parker. They wouldn't share their pulpits with him or organizational membership with him. So eventually he left his West Roxbury church in 1846 and formed the 28th Congregational Society in Boston, sort of his own church. He preached to large crowds of over 1,000 every Sunday, and he became known as an abolitionist and reformer. He was active in the Underground Railroad and was reported to keep a loaded pistol in his desk. because of threats to his life. So much for gun control. Parker's quote about the arc of the moral universe can be understood as a transcendental way of moving beyond the notion of God in and of history, or a way of reframing it. But it still remains a statement of belief and a framing for understanding and meaning for our individual lives. There is a moral arc that we can bend toward goodness through our choices and our actions. That's what we say. And then it's our third name. It was Susan B. Anthony who did just that. And I commend to you reading some of her biography. Wikipedia actually does a good job on this biography, if you just want to read down and see how much she did. She committed her life to activism and reform. She was a model for commitment and resilience. And also, she was from Massachusetts. Strong Quaker roots. The family moved to Rochester, New York in 1845. She was 25, and they began attending the Rochester Unitarian Church, where the minister was William Henry Channing. But he had been raised by his uncle, William Ellery Channing. But now he, too, was a transcendentalist. Historian Robinson characterizes him as a leader in pre-Civil War social reform movements and an exemplar of the social conscience of the transcendentalist movement. So Susan B. Anthony maintained her Quaker connections for her whole life, and in 1857 served as, listen to this, secretary for the Friends of Human Progress. And that was a group that promoted social reform and welcomed everyone, including, quote, Christians, Jews, Mohammedans, and pagans. And that was 160 years ago. Anthony was an abolitionist, educational reformer, labor activist, temperance worker, suffragist, women's rights campaigner. In each category is its own detailed resume of accomplishment. And she traveled, lectured, and canvassed across the nation. But think how she did it, often by horse and buggy, to secure the right to vote for women. She died on March 13th. That's why originally I was going to do this talk in March, and we got snowed out. March 13th, 1906, 14 years before the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920, which was named after her. Fran Schneider was a member of this congregation who remembers her mother going to vote in 1920, and the impression that that made on her. In a speech in 1889, Anthony noted that women had always been taught that their purpose was to serve men. But now, she said, after 40 years of agitation, the idea is beginning to prevail, and I would say that anyone, but it, that women were created for themselves, for their own happiness, and for the welfare of the world. She was sure that women's suffrage would be achieved. One of her quotes that became a motto was what? Do you remember that? Failure is impossible. But she also feared that people would forget how difficult it was to achieve anything. She said, "We shall someday be heeded, and when we shall have our amendment to the Constitution of the United States, everybody will think it was always so. Just exactly as many young people think that all the privileges, all the freedom, all the enjoyments which women now possess, which woman now possesses, always were hers. They have no idea of how every single inch of ground that she stands upon today has been gained by the hard work of some little handful of women in the past. Failure is impossible." Some little handful of people doing their part. Annie Dillard said, "There are no formerly heroic times, and there was no formerly pure generation there is no one here to be that small handful of people but us chickens. And so it has always been. There never was a more holy age than ours, and never a less. I referenced that panel on this last Monday night at Trinity Presbyterian. It was put on by parents and friends of lesbians and gays. And there I was sitting up front of 60 people in Trinity Presbyterian's fellowship hall. There was Rabbi Jackson on the right, forgotten the woman's name who was sitting in for Joan, the minister of New Creation. And then there was Mark Stanley, Trinity Presbyterian, and Richard Weidler of First Congregational, and then myself. And each one of them was speaking about passages of Scripture. If you take a Bible, you've seen it, and you say, how many passages do you think here talk about homosexuality? You take it and shake it out. 8 little pieces of paper fall out of the entire Bible. Of 30-some thousand verses, there are like 8 little pieces that fall out. Mark actually did that to demonstrate it. But if you think about that room, there is a Unitarian sitting next to the Congregationalists. There's the history, that space, how we got to here. There's a sort of a Transcendentalist, probably more than anything else I could name, next to all the people of the book, working with passages of Scripture. We all did our thing and said what programs were going on in our congregations, and then the audience thanked us. But we were in Trinity Presbyterian Church, and I can remember where we couldn't have been there and had that forum and had 60 people present. First Congregationalist Church is now known as an open and affirming congregation. So we all got thanked, and there was Jerry Miller who put this on. He's the head of Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. And we called Jerry over, and this fits into this whole history sense of how did we get here. And we remembered Jerry for when none of this was. We remembered Jerry for holding the space. We remembered Jerry for calling me up and saying, I just read that Mud Creek Baptist Church is welcoming gays and lesbians in big print, but if you read in the small print, it says, what? If you'll change, and we'll help you change. It's sort of like a credit card application. So Jerry was looking for a place to hold some kind of event. So he called me, and I said, yes, sure. I don't have to ask the board. We can do it. You know, but the others it had to go, and he wanted to schedule it. So we did it, and we called it Love Welcomes All. And then it grew to be too big to be held here, actually. So we held it at Trinity Presbyterian. We actually went through that. Well, in that group at that time, First Congregational Church wasn't open and affirming. They were trying to go through the process. Look at what they've become. How did they become that? From Love Welcomes All, connecting to Helen Bishop to help them facilitate their process in their congregation. And there was Trinity having these conversations around what was going on. And here it was, we were playing, all of us playing our little role in that. And then it goes back to Gene and Jim Allen, who were heads of PFLAG for years, when all they could do was meet in a room where you had access to it by ways that nobody would see you go in. And there we were, sitting out in the open. While I was there in that meeting, I was missing one that was being held to discuss sanctuary for immigrants, right in Hendersonville. I had a talk that morning about what we are doing and can be doing for refugees. And I met a pagan from Colorado Springs who just happened to be talking about that in front of me in the checkout line, the co-op, and I got to say to him, can I give your number to Regina Hutchison, who is the head of our Coven of UU Pagans? So there you have it. Christians, Jews, Mohammedans, pagans in Hendersonville. So what does Margaret Mead say in that quote that you know, number 561 in the hymnal? Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can do what? Change the world. Bend the arc. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens, never doubt that you, together, can change the world. And she ends by saying what? Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Be resilient. Take the first step this Palm Sunday towards bending that arc towards justice.